Hey, I'm Johanna Wagstaff.
And hi there, I'm Rohith Joseph.
And we're asking for 10 minutes of your day to go through the 10 things that the UN recommends we can all do when it comes to climate change.
Please don't leave.
No.
And also, the things aren't new.
We are just wired to not do them.
We promise you to help you figure out your brains, and you and your people can make better choices to combat climate change.
10 Minutes to Save the Planet is available now on CBC Listen and everywhere you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hey, I'm Tom Power. Welcome to Q.
So it's New York. It's like Manhattan. The 2016 election is coming up. You remember the 2016 election? That was the Donald Trump, Hillary Clinton one. Do I need to remind you who won? No, I don't. Okay. You're watching a group of gay men talking about how they're worried about the outcome of the election. They're worried about the rolling back of their civil rights that could happen. And then they're also talking about living through, surviving, and those they lost in the AIDS crisis. That sort of sets the scene for this play called The Inheritance, which is a loose adaptation of a really famous novel called Howard's End, which was written by E.M. Forster. E.M. Forster, really important 20th century novelist, also gay, but kept it under wraps. And that novel, Howard's End, is sort of the way a very modern story is told about this guy named Eric Glass and this guy named Toby Darling, who are a young couple set to be married. They're living downstairs. Upstairs is a very wealthy gay couple. And the conversations and interactions between the two of them about class, about history, about sexuality sort of forms the basis of the play. I'm being sort of vague because it's a very complex work, and it's a very complex work in that it's 7 hours long, but it's also been called one of the most important plays of the 21st century. And these 7-hour shows have been packed and sold out. The Canadian director Brendan Healy took this play, The Inheritance, on, and he staged it in Toronto at Canadian Stage with a really stellar group of actors. And he came into the studio to talk to me about it, talk to me about the importance of it, what drew him to it, and how you stage a 7-hour play. Here's my conversation with Brendan Healy. Welcome to the show. How are you?
I'm very well. Thank you.
7 hours. I just want to say it right off the bat.
It flies by.
Well, I was going to say, there's a world in which I talk to you and I go like, geez, seven hours. What I'm almost more interested in is that it's 7 hours, three and a half hour acts, right?
Correct.
And it's been jammed. It's been packed. What does that mean to you?
Well, I think it's a great story. And the writing is so fantastic. You completely fall in love with the characters. It's almost like binge watching like an amazing Netflix series where you just totally become engrossed in the story and the people.
What's the hardest thing about staging a 7-hour play?
It's a bit of a stamina thing. It's like a marathon, working on it and then certainly performing it for the actors. It requires a kind of commitment and an energy that is almost athletic.
Are you thinking about the audience? Like, okay, they need to be sort of every half hour, 45 minutes, they need to make sure they're engaged? Because it's quite a commitment.
Yeah. Certainly, you know, staging-wise, I really made an effort to keep things changing visually. You know, the set is constantly changing and evolving. So, you know, for an audience, the story is really engaging, but also visually, I think there's a lot to kind of keep you interested.
How did the story first come to you?
Well, you know, it's a bit of a legendary play in the theater community. It premiered in London and very quickly transferred to the West End. It won a ton of Olivier Awards and then went to Broadway, where it won a ton of Tony Awards. So I you know, ended up on my desk. I'm constantly reading plays from around the world. And, you know, reading the play was a really, really special experience. And I got to see the production, which was even more just, you know, like a very, very significant moment for me in the theater.
Where?
I saw it in Los Angeles.
Okay. And you said it was a really significant moment for you.
It was an incredible production.
Why? What's that? You didn't say incredible production, though. You said a significant moment for me in theater. And someone with your theater background, I'm interested to know what that means.
I think for me, you know, as a gay man, there's so few experiences where I feel seen within an intergenerational community. Often, gay stories are quite generationally siloed. But what's special about The Inheritance is that literally every generation of gay man sees themselves in the story and sees themselves in relationship to one another. So that was very moving for me because it's not something that I live with consciously, a feeling of disconnect from my elders, but the play really kind of revealed a kind of loss that I wasn't even aware of, and then also filled that loss with a kind of connectivity, which was really, really has been very healing.
A loss sort of between stories between generations or a connection to other generations of gay men.
Well, the loss of a generation.
Yeah.
You know, I'm 48, so I'm certainly no spring chicken. But, you know, there are so few elders in my life because so many of them died.
I want to talk a little bit about how it tells a sort of competing but also complementary stories of sort of anxiety and trauma that you're sort of alluding to there. But first, I want to talk a little bit about Forster. So the play, The Inheritance, is by Matthew Lopez, but the play was inspired by the 19th century author and early 20th century author E.M. Forster and his novel Howard's End. Can you do some work here for me? Can you tell me a little bit about Forster, the original novel, and how it makes its way into the story?
Yeah. I mean, Forster is a very important literary figure who was a closeted gay man and, in fact, wrote a very, very important gay novel called Morris, which he kept hidden from the world until after his death in 1970. But his work is about a lot about class and sort of class relations in Edwardian England. But his whole sort of moral underpinning of his work is encapsulated in this very famous quote from Howard's End called "Only Connect." And for him, the secret to good life was only to be found through connection to others, but also connections within ourselves, that we tend to live fragmented lives, fragmented from each other, but also fragmented within ourselves. And so really the message of Howard's End is to build those connections between things that may feel like opposites, people who may feel different to us. And so that became, I think, sort of the driving inspiration for The Inheritance, which is really driven by a similar ethos, which is gay men need to connect with one another across class, across generations. One of the biggest questions that the play asks is, what is our responsibility to one another as gay men? What do we owe each other? Do we owe each other anything? And I think the play makes a very, very strong case about why we have a responsibility to one another.
That case and that story is told through Eric, the protagonist of the play. Tell me a little bit about Eric.
Eric is, you know, you're kind of your typical 30-something guy who's, you know, trying to find his way in the world and is trying to carve out a place that feels authentic to who he is. He just doesn't know how and is living a life that he thinks is the life that he's meant to live, but through the course of the story really discovers that he is actually not living his authentic life and through the story finds a greater purpose.
One of the things you alluded to earlier and a couple of times is the intergenerational conversations that these characters are sort of having with one another. The challenge in trying to talk about a 7-hour play in 20 minutes is we can only sort of hit on little parts of it. But one of them is sort of like the cross-generational conversations that are happening around issues that have, and I want to be careful here, issues that have affected gay men in the past and in another way still affect them. For instance, the AIDS crisis in the 80s, which you were talking about earlier. And then gay men of the present, especially the present of 2016 in the play, a Trump presidency which may roll back civil rights.
Which have
rolled back civil rights. I think at the moment they're thinking, okay, how bad? How is this going to be?
Yes.
Talk to me a little bit about some of the anxieties you wanted to convey here in this show.
I think that a lot of communities benefit from stories that give communities a sense of history and a sense of struggle and an understanding of how they got to be where they are today. That's not necessarily so present in the gay community. Often, community is very focused on the present, with just only a real vague awareness of what its history is. So I think this play attempts to begin to introduce the notion that there is such a thing as a gay heritage, that as gay men, we share although we're very diverse, we do share a kind of heritage. And that heritage is one that is forged in struggle, in triumph, in loss. And that heritage, I think the play is trying to advocate that heritage provides the community with a kind of strength that it will at some point have to rely on to combat the kind of constant forces of oppression that sort of seem to constantly exist in society.
So a couple of things on that. When was the play written? When was The Inheritance written?
It was written in 2018.
All right. So I just want to come back to something you said, which I sort of breezed past, which is worth talking about. 2018. Mm-hmm. The 2 years into the Trump presidency, 2 years into the sort of concern that the civil rights are going to be rolled back, you're absolutely right, Brennan. Like they have been rolled back. Is that on your mind when you're staging this in 2024?
Yeah, of course, absolutely. And we don't have to look just at the states. I mean, what's happened in Alberta is very concerning. You know, one of the things that the play talks about is that the advancement of queer liberation is not equally experienced within the community. That certainly, you know, as a cisgendered white gay male, I've benefited from a lot of advancement in political and social clout. But there are many, many members of the community that have been left behind. So I think that, you know, among the things that drew me to the play was its desire to communicate to an audience that we have a responsibility to advance everybody's rights together. And just because I seem to live a very free life doesn't mean that my siblings are. And certainly, what's happening to the trans community is very, very concerning. And it's we have a responsibility as a community to look out for one another.
What conversations are happening? Because there's the conversation that's happening on stage, right, between generations. My guess is that there'd be similar conversations happening in I can see you nodding there. Similar conversations that are happening in rehearsals. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. I mean, the rehearsal hall was fascinating because literally we had everyone, every decade from the 20s to the 70s were in that cast. And it was remarkable to see how the conversations in the rehearsal hall mirrored exactly the conversations that would happen on stage.
Tell me what you mean. What do you mean by that?
Well,
you don't have to go into specifics.
Yeah. I mean, the question of, you know, is there such a thing as gay culture? Is that actually a real thing? You know, one thing that I find so fascinating as a gay man is, you know, long before I had any concept of sort of my sexual desire, I loved Bea Arthur.
Right.
Like I was 8 years old, obsessed with Bea Arthur.
Yeah.
What's up with that?
Golden Girls.
Girls.
Yeah, right.
I mean, it is so gay.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. It's this weird thing about being a gay person is, you know, what made me, you know, what drew me to Bea Arthur?
Mm-hmm.
No straight boy likes Bea Arthur mm-hmm. at 8 years old.
Mm-hmm.
So that, you know, there's a lot of conversation around, well, is there such a thing as a gay culture? And what has happened to that gay culture as it's become a lot more mainstream, you know? And as aspects of gay culture become more part of the general culture, are we losing something really special? The kind of secret nature of gay culture, are we losing something as things become more mainstream? Really interesting conversation to hear someone in their 60s in conversation with, you know, someone in their 20s who basically grew up on Drag Race.
Yeah.
It's remarkable.
It must have been fascinating and meaningful for you to see these conversations happening. Again, I want to point out to people listening, we're not talking about the conversations these are actually conversations that happen in the play.
Yes.
But also they're happening backstage. That must have been meaningful to you.
Yeah, absolutely. And also the history around AIDS. And, you know, it's not something that's necessarily taught in schools. We don't have queer history 101 in high school. So a lot of young people, not all young people, but a lot of young people and certainly certain members of the cast weren't just fully aware of what that moment was.
Yeah.
And that to me is, you know, any opportunity to share knowledge and particularly lived experience is just like such a gift.
Well, a gift and a responsibility. We had Bill T. Jones in here.
Oh my God.
How long ago was that, Lise? Like maybe two or three weeks ago. So he sits down in front of me. We're having this, you know, got along grand. We had a grand old chat. But right off the bat, I've never had anyone do this to me before. He sits down and he goes, "Hi, Tom." I said, "Hi, Bill. How you doing?" He says, "I want to let you know that I'm a bit of a talker. I'm a bit of a storyteller, you know. And, oh, well, geez, Bill, that's this radio show, buddy. You know, that's fine by me. And he said, the reason I want to tell you that, he said, I have a responsibility to tell these stories, because the responsibility lies in transmitting the story of what happened with AIDS in the 80s anecdotally. I carry my responsibility anecdotally. And he went on to talk about the tragedy and he feels if he doesn't do his job enough and let folks, in particular young gay folks, know the massacre, the trauma. I mean, he lost his husband, he lost all of his friends around him. So I think you're talking about something similar there, that there's a danger. Can you relate to that, danger that this knowledge is lost?
Absolutely. It's a huge danger. Because in that trauma, there's wisdom.
Can you tell me a little bit about the scene that everything I've read in the play has talked about, this very moving scene where some folks who haven't been in the play up to that point sort of show up in the theater. As much as you want to talk about that, not give too much away.
Yeah, it's the way the first part of the play ends is it's a very moving moment. You know, the part of the story revolves around this home in upstate New York that served as a kind of impromptu hospice for men who were dying of AIDS in the 80s when they had nowhere else to go. Hospitals were horrible places for AIDS patients at the time. You know, they'd be isolated and just treated terribly. So this home served as a place where these men could die with dignity. And one of the characters of the play visits the home and encounters the spirits of the men who died there. And these spirits are embodied by, you know, members of our community who are HIV positive, and these brave, beautiful men who come onto the stage. And for me, it's a moment that's special because it does a bunch of things. One thing is it kind of breaks, you know, the fiction and the quote unquote fourth wall and brings reality onto the stage. That this is, like, you know, this is a real thing. People live with this. And that, I think, is any opportunity in the theater to remind people that, you know, this is real is always good. The second thing that it does is, you know, so much of the conversation around AIDS is focused on absence, which is important, but this moment is about presence.
Yeah.
And it's about honoring the men who live with HIV, who thrive with HIV, and that, you know, these men are very much, you know, a part of our community, and their presence in a way is a kind of tribute to the absence of those who did not make it. So it's a very, I find it to be a very, very powerful moment. It just makes everything land in a very real, concrete way when you see these men on stage.
How did they rehearse? What were the rehearsals like for that?
You know, brief. You know, it was a bit, we sort of built everything around them. And then, you know, there was this glorious moment when our guests showed up and we integrated them into the production. And, you know, we'd been anticipating their arrival for weeks, and it was magnificent. They're really an extraordinary group of men. It takes courage to step in front of 800 people and own your status. There's still stigma, and they do it so open-heartedly and so beautifully. It's a really very, very special thing.
I'm Tom Power. You're listening to Q. Coming up, more of my conversation with Brendan Healy.
Hi, I'm Jessie Cruikshank.
Jessie Cruikshank.
I host the number one comedy podcast called Phone a Friend.
Girl, let's phone a friend.
Not only do I break down the biggest stories in pop culture with guests like Dan Levy and members of NSYNC, I do it with my own personal boy band singing jingles throughout. Because it's my show.
It's your show, girl.
New episodes of Phone a Friend.
Yeah.
Drop Thursdays wherever you get your podcasts.
So work it, girl. Yeah, work it.
Okay, that's enough.
Uh, I'm cautious about doing a very CBC thing and only focusing on the trauma and sadness in this show.
Is that a CBC thing?
Don't you think so? Don't
maybe.
You think it's kind of a CBC thing? Like, hey, your 7-hour show, let's talk about the saddest parts of it. But so I may be on that. I wanted to ask you, what's been a moment in this process that's given you the most joy?
I mean, frankly, it's all been joy. It hasn't been a traumatic experience. I think that, I mean, for me, making theater is the most joyful thing that I can do. You know, the theater is such a weird thing because, you know, we talk in the theater obsessively about the truth, you know, the truth of a moment, the truth of a scene.
Yeah.
And yet it's all make-believe.
Yeah.
And to me, it reveals something about us as humans. You know, it's a bit like the idea that you can't stare directly at the sun, that our way into the truth as humans is often through some back door, some fiction. But when you touch upon the truth in a communal way, when you're in a room with other people and we all feel it, it's truly the most joyful thing possible.
When did you first figure that out? When did you first feel that?
I mean, probably the first play I ever did.
Which was what?
Oh, it was like some made-up play. What was it? You know, I was 7 years old. And,
seven?
Yeah.
I thought you were going to say like 21 or something.
No,
like that.
No. My mom, you know, sent me to some summer camp thing. And I'll never forget this. You know, the person organizing it asked me, you know, if you could be anything in the world, what would you be? And they were going to build a play around that. And no one had ever asked me that question before. And I got to be that person. And in being that person, I touched on some elemental truth within me. I could feel it even as a kid.
Really?
That, you know, that my interior life is real and that the theater gave me a platform to somehow manifest that interior life and to have other people witness it and understand it and connect with it. I mean, it changed my life.
What? That small moment of someone... What was the question they asked you?
If you could be one thing, what would that be?
And you said...
I want to be a king.
Okay. Well,
I'm seven.
I misunderstood. I thought you said, I want to be a theater...
No.
Impresario.
I just want to be a king.
And it was the question itself...
It was the question
that
itself.
...that made you realize that your internal life had value, that meaning.
Exactly.
That was...
That it mattered.
Jesus, Brandon, that's a powerful thing.
Right. That's theater, baby.
The more I learn about it, the more this theater got legs.
It's been around for a while.
This whole medium's got legs, you know. I think it's gonna do okay. You were artistic director of Buddy Sinbad. This is part of the show where I debate whether or not theater has value. You were artistic director of Buddies in Bad Times for years, which has become a venerable institution in Toronto, especially for the queer community. It really incredible run. Were there things you learned during your time there that you brought to the Inheritance?
The experience of running Buddies was transformational because my sexual identity became the center of my aesthetic. And sort of the merging of sexual identity and aesthetic was really, really powerful for me as an artist. So at Canadian Stage, certainly it's a much more, you know, mainstream company that speaks to many, many communities. And I love that about Canadian Stage. But that sort of merging of sex and art is something that it just totally changed me as an artist. And so coming into the Inheritance, that, you know, that was very much, very much alive in the whole process.
I want to close off by asking you a little bit about, you talked in the back about it, in the beginning, I should say, about how the thing that the phrase that keeps on coming up in Forster's original novel is only connect. And I love how you talked about this, that it's not just the idea of connecting to one another through things like empathy and compassion, but also to our interior lives and to our exterior lives.
That's like, often the hardest thing to do.
It would be a lot easier if the lesson was connect with the people around you and love them. The hardest thing is to connect with your sort of internal self. How has making this work or adapting this work made you reflect just broadly on Only Connect?
Well, I think, you know, certainly I carry a kind of trauma around AIDS. I kind of came into my sexual being right at the height of the crisis. And by accepting that I was gay and by coming out, I consciously or maybe even subconsciously thought, well, this means I'm going to die. And that's just you know, my need to connect sexually with other men is maybe the thing that's going to take me down. And, you know, the anxiety, the constant anxiety around sex, coupled with this, you know, insatiable need for it, you know, is a kind of trauma, which I've buried and I've moved on. I'm on PrEP. Life goes on, blah, blah, blah. But this play has enabled me to experience that wounding and has allowed me to begin to heal, because it's not something we talk about. Like, gay men, we don't sit around and talk about, like, so that was really traumatic, you know, being in, you know, a 17, 18-year-old sexually active gay man in, you know, 1991.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. You don't sit around and go, like, that was crazy.
That was crazy.
Yeah.
And holy shit, did that shape the way that I
Yeah.
But this play allows me to kind of have that conversation.
It must be meaningful to be able to have that conversation.
Yeah, it's very meaningful.
That's been sort of been there for a while. And judging by the amount of people who are seeing this thing, it seems that a lot of people are having that same sort of emotional reaction to it. I really appreciate you coming in.
It's been an absolute pleasure, and thank you for making space for this story on your show.
It's my conversation with the Canadian director, Brendan Healy. The Inheritance is on at Canadian Stage in Toronto until April 14th. The other conversation we have up today is what they call a rebroadcast, a re-airing, a re-up of my conversation with Joan Baez, the legendary folk singer. Like a lot of artists who are getting on in their years, she's starting to think a little bit about her legacy. And she feels that for everything that's been written about her and all the acclaim she's gotten, the legacy she has been leaving up to this point is not an honest one. And she wants to change that. She'll tell you what she needs. Go check that podcast out. We'll see you soon. Later up.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.